Hey Cheshvan, Wednesday the 9th of October, Rabbi Yonis and Shuter, the second bias, its meaning for us.
Hey, good morning everybody. Thank you very much for having me once again. A special thank you to Dudi. Is he not here? Okay.
We're listening.
Okay. So it does take a lot of work in arranging these things. I could see really this time and there's a lot of backwards and forwards. And so I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here. So probably wondering what this share is actually going to be about. So what happened was I was writing a book on the Moyadim, on all the festivals, and being a sort of trying to get completion, I wanted to have something on every single month of the year. So it was great, you know, start Nisaniya, all was going smoothly until I get to Cheshvan. So what on earth am I going to speak about for Cheshvan? So after much intense thought and decision, we came to the conclusion, you know what, we can speak about Shabbos, we can speak about Rosh Chodesh. And it was that sort of look into Inyanim of Rosh Chodesh that brought about the topic which I'd like to share with you today. Oh, that's right. There's a very interesting question which is dealt with by the Ramban, and we're going to focus on the words of Yaakov Kamenetsky. He asked the question as follows. Very simple question, Nisan, Nia, Sivan, etc. What kinds of names are these? These are essentially Persian names that that came from Bavel. Why on earth would we retain the names? Let's just see how this is dealt with. The Ramban, he explains that when the Jews came out of Egypt, everything was called Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh HaSheni. Why? Because, to remember, this is the first month from the Yetzias Mitzrayim. It was all about commemorating the Yetzias Mitzrayim. However, by the time they came back from Bovel, they had to be Mekayem a Pasuk that said, the Pasuk in Yirmiyah that says, V'lo yomer od chai Hashem asher helanu es b'nei sol me'etz Mitzrayim, ki im chai Hashem asher ha'ala asher hevi es b'nei sol me'etz Safoin. In other words, essentially, when the Jews would emerge from the lands of the north, namely Bovel, that would sort of overshadow the going out from Egypt, and therefore, to remember that, he says, so they would, in order to commemorate the going out from Bavel, they would keep the names of the months that they used in Bavel. So,
if there's some of the names after Baal, some of the names after Persian God.
Exactly. So that's the first question. This is where Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky steps in, and he asks essentially at least three questions, of which are, the first one is, firstly, why do we leave the Loshon HaTorah, the Torah's Loshon, and instead we pick up this strange language and use it for generations, and so much so that some of them are something to do with Avodah Zarah. That's his first question. The second question is that in the Bias Sheni, the language that they used was this Aramis. This, what do they call it, Aramaic. But on second, in Egypt, we know they were given, the Jews were praised that they kept four things, and one of them was they kept the language. So why everyone in Israel, in Eretz Israel, is suddenly speaking Aramaic. Thirdly, he brings down, so Rav Yaakov brings down a famous Gemara in Yuma. Once upon a time, there was someone in Bais Sheni. He was walking around the Beis HaMikdash, and he noticed that there was a tile misplaced. And he worked out from there, yes, this must be the place where the Aroin, the Holy Aroin, was hidden. Now, this person was someone he couldn't quite keep a secret, so what did he do? He tried to bring a friend along and tell him, this is the place. And before he even got there, this person died. So we see clearly that the second bias was meant to be an aroinless bias. There was the luchois were absent, and that's how the second bias functioned. What was the reason? Why was this hidden for us? So this is where Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky steps in with his yosoid, and he says as follows. And this is quite an eye opener because we're accustomed to thinking, you know, there was the bias Rishon and the bias Sheni and. What happened, a bit more, a bit less, but we come to think of them as somewhat equivalent-ish sort of periods. However, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's Yosoid, is as follows. He says that when the Jews came up from Bavel, they knew at the outset that this wasn't going to be a permanent situation. In other words, there was a sort of countdown until the bias shading was going to be destroyed. It was never meant to be a permanent bias. The Gula, this wasn't the Gula Shalema which they were hoping for, and they knew it. In fact, didn't the elders, when they came back, they were crying about this bias shading, you know, it had nothing, no resemblance whatsoever to the miracles and the Kedusha that took place in the first bias, namely because the absent, the main thing of the bias Rishon and the Mishkan was the Aron. That is the center, the Luchos, the Torah, and that's how the Shechina spreads out into the and fills the Beis HaMikdash, and from which goes out to the world. With the absence of these of this, okay, it was some kind of lower degree of intensity level of Shechina operating, and as we'll discover, it wasn't at all so poshut. So, what was the purpose then in being brought back? Because the Jews already in Bavel were at such a low level, they were at risk of getting totally lost, totally immersed amongst the nations. Had they remained there longer than this 70 years, there wouldn't have actually been anyone left to redeem. It would have been essentially a total assimilation. There wouldn't have been anything left. We needed a few key figures as who they were. They brought them back to Eretz Yisrael. So what was the purpose of being brought back into Eretz Yisrael? It was to instill them once again with the emunah, with the bitachon, the belief in Hashem, to give them chizuk, because there was a far longer golus coming up. And therefore, this period of the bias sheni was actually a preparation for the longer golus that was going to take place. And that explains why the Aron was hidden, because this wasn't the Gula Shalema. And now all these questions that we asked are essentially miyushav. So therefore, why did they use the names that were used in Golos? Because it was meant to be for them a simon as to, this is actually something to do with Bavel. The Aron was going to be hidden. They kept these names, and therefore the names of the months that we started with, that's why they were used, and the language. And also this explains why the Gemara Yerushalmi was written in Aramaic, even though it was written in Yerushalayim. But no, at the time, they were in Eretz Yisrael, but they were within this sort of Golos Arichta, even within Eretz Yisrael. And also, says Rav Yaakov, it explains why there was no king at the time from Shevet Yehuda. You had these Hashmonaim, Maccabees operating, who weren't from the Shevet of Yehuda. Why? A king from Yehuda would have had resemblance to do with the Gula Shalema. The Hashmonaim and all that was a more sort of short-term affair as such. There's an interesting point he says, it's brought down in the footnote there, but therefore Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said it elsewhere, but he said that the reason for being brought back into, why they came back from Bavel into Eretz Yisrael, was in order to arrange Torah for generations. Torah is what we needed to survive the long Golos. I suppose with the first Beis HaMikdash, at that time it wasn't all complete. They hadn't completed the Talmud. The period of the second Beis HaMikdash brought this all together, and now they would be ready, essentially, for the coming Golos. And he says with Yaakov, he's an interesting thing, which, exactly what he means, can be thought about, but essentially what he says is so too. Post the destruction 60, 70 years ago, the Jews coming back into Eretz Yisrael was to ensure that there would be an absolute chizuk in the standards that were needed for survival. In other parts, all in Golos, no, we needed something more, perhaps, that would be going on in Eretz Yisrael. So, that's his yesod there. For myself, I was sort of wondering, so therefore, what does that mean? Does that mean that the time of the Bias Sheni, could it have been, therefore, that really there was only one Golos, and even this period of the Bias Sheni was sort of it's a Golos Arichta, even within Eretz Yisrael? Or perhaps you could look at it, no, there was the first period of Golos, there was some kind of hefsek, an interruption, some kind of very low degree of intensity of Kedusha, but it was still a respite as such from the Golos. And then the second Golos that we're now in is a sort of a new beginning. So that can be sort of discussed as well. Another thing which I was wondering for myself was that you know, you find the, and this is sort of my own Chiddush, so it's, what I've been saying till now is from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, so I'm on firm ground, but just my own idea was, well, you know, we all know the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of three terrible sins, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. So I was sort of wondering, so what exactly happened within the sort of 70 years? They went to Bavel, then they came back, and suddenly this whole thing of Sinas Chinam, which in the Yesod B'Shoresh was, it affected totally the insides of the Jewish people, a sort of panimius dicker matter. So where did that come from? I was sort of wondering, perhaps the time in Bavel, maybe, where things were so low, that's how they got into a position that they wouldn't quite be able to, and it affected the panimius. So therefore, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because perhaps what they had sort of ascended to already because of the golus of the first Beis HaMikdash. It's a suggestion. Take it or leave it. So, just to mention, there's a Sforno here where he discusses the differences. What would we have thought? Let's just find the Sforno for a second. Yeah. So if we would take a look, you know, we would think to ourselves, what was the best, you know, the best Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, how do we sort of view all these things? Whoever hasn't seen the second Beis HaMikdash hasn't seen a beautiful building in his life. Is that a Gemara somewhere? Yes? Okay. And the first Beis HaMikdash, Solomon's, and the Mishkan, some kind of tent, you know, animal skins and wood, acacia wood, covered in gold, but some kind of schwache Meise, you know, a tent. So we would have thought the greatest thing would be the second Beis HaMikdash. Says the Sforno, actually it's not so. He says, in fact, in the Mishkan, there was four tanaim, four conditions were there that were present in the time of the first, in the time of the Mishkan, and it was only downhill, essentially, from there. He says, what's the first one? That you had the luchois, the original luchois. Secondly, it was orchestrated by Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one in charge. Thirdly, the work was done through the Levim, and Itamar were involved in the building. And fourthly, Bezalel was from the tribe of Yehuda, and he was also in charge, perhaps because he was from Yehuda, whatever, however he learns it. But basically, his point is, the Mishkan never fell into enemy hands, even though it eventually got replaced, but it was put into storage, and one day, you know, might turn up again. Come along the first Beis HaMikdash, and some of these conditions were lacking. The way King Shlomo HaMelech orchestrated it was that we had these work, people were sort of forced into working at some point, some of the workers were even non-Jewish. And therefore, the first Beis HaMikdash actually, not everything from there lasted. And the second Beis HaMikdash, you had none of these conditions. It was done by this Roman slave, wasn't he?
Herod,
all right. Herod's, they're going to have beautiful marble pillars and the most amazing structure, and yet in terms of kedusha, it has nothing there. So it reminds me, I was once, you know, once in Israel, I was sort of moved from one home into another home that was a little bit larger. You know, I was all sort of happy, and as my wife was unpacking, I went along to hear of David Cohen, the Rosh Hashiva of Hebron. And he spoke in Hebrew, so you know, I only answered so much, but one thing he said was that Ruchnius and Gashmius are shtei tzoras hein, the famous Gemara. The point being that the more Gashmius there is, that's the second bias, the less Ruchnius there is. The first, what was the Mishkan, sort of came out very little of Gashmius, and it was total Ruchnius. Everything was there in the first, in the time of the first in the time of the Mishkan. So at that point, it sort of it made an impression. So now, on this, so what we see is there's this sort of Yerida from when you have your time of the Midbar and everything. And what was the Midbar? A totally supernatural existence, man from Hashem, and you know, not worrying about this and that, but it was totally total sort of connection as such. So that was the highest level ever experienced. The first base of Mikdash was great. But we see there is this sort of downhill, slowly descending level. And this is where a second piece, it's somewhat separate, but you also see this idea come into play. This is also another piece of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, so it's also very interesting to see the thoughts, how he brings in this sort of perspective of factors into his pshatim. And he asks a question. He's talking, this comes about in 10 plagues, without going too much into it, but what was the 10 plagues? They were to imbibe, you know, why do we have the famous question, why is there 10 plagues, why not one plague? You know, get it all over and done with already. Why did the Egyptians have to go through this? The answer is not necessarily for the Egyptians, but for us, that we would read these plagues and have a munah that everything is from Hashem, and that was meant to be the lesson for generations. So much so that in Egypt, you know, every little 3-year-old in Gan, kindergarten, they call it, kindergarten, Gan, whatever it is, was, you know, instead of playing football or something, they would, you know, let's turn water into blood, you know, let's make frogs into rabbits, and that was it. The whole country was full of this kishuf. So his question is, why is it nowadays, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, why is it nowadays we don't find any real great practitioning of kishuv? You know, we're missing it, but we don't see shadim, dibukim, apart from, you know, fishy stories, but essentially these things have been somewhat, you know, we're lacking, you know, that's, the question is why? And his yasoid essentially is like this. He says that what was the purpose of all these things? That there had to be bechira. There had to be sort of free will. In other words, life is meant to be, you know, a test. It's meant to be able to choose this way or that way. If something is totally crystal clear, then that's not called bechira. That's not making a choice. You're forced into something if you have total clarity. Rather, he says, there has to be the purpose of all these other things, these other forces, black magic, white magic, whatever it is, it's in order that there should be a makom ta'os, a place in which a person might err, he might make a mistake, and now he has free will. So he has a choice, can choose one way, choose the other. It's, if there would have only been, you know, one, everything was total clarity, for example, at the Kriyas Yam Suf, you had Hashem, amazing miracle, lift up the hands, splits. However, what did Hashem do? Says Rabbi Yaakov, he planted this strong wind that blew, and therefore, it'd be great, now in future generations, people could say, well, you know, it wasn't quite Hashem, you know, there was a strong wind, and, you know, there are these articles, great, you know, professors, you know, cultured people, who write that to explain everything away. Even the 10 plagues, you can say, there was this, that, and the other. But this is the idea. Hashem implanted a makom tos. There should be a place to err. Baal Tzefon was all the idols of Egypt were destroyed. One little idol was knocking around there. Now, you think Paro would sort of be rational, you know, let's face it, all the other idols were destroyed and there was only this one there. But no, that makom tos, that place to err, was enough. That was enough to throw him off. There's a very interesting, I suppose you could call it a machloikes. If you look in the Ramban, in the Perush HaMishnayos, in Avodah Zarah Perek Dalet, he's got this whole long piece. And essentially he's discussing, you know, all these magic and all these forces that we've been talking about. And he comes to the conclusion, and he says that he says all the philosophers laugh at these things, that there's absolutely nothing in these koifas, it's all ridiculous. And the Rambam agrees. He says people get carried away. You know, even Bizman Azim, people get a bit sort of carried away that they've seen this and that and heard this and that. Says the Rambam, there's absolutely nothing, there's nothing in any of these things. So, you know, don't even waste time. It's biffle whatever, biffle Torah or something. And then he says, why does the Torah tell us, you know, to keep away from these things? Not because there's anything in these things, but rather because, just like one keeps away from sheker, distance oneself from sheker, something that's not true, keep away from it. So that's what these things are, just pure sheker. Now, we have a problem, because we find there is this Gemara, well, not this Gemara, there's many Gemaras, which speak about, there was the Dibbuk, and there was the demon, and the this, and the that, and the Gemara clearly speaks about all these things. So now, what's the Rambam seems to be coming up against the Mefurash Gemaras, how am I meant to understand this? Also, we find in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a halacha that says if one's bitten by a scorpion on Shabbos, you can say certain things over it, whatever they are, look up there. And why can you say these things? You're not meant to do a refuah. But the point is that even though these things don't help, because he thinks they do, so therefore it's okay. Says the Gra, he says, therefore this ruling must have come from the Rambam. He holds that these things are ineffective. So therefore that's why it's mutter to say these certain things. So we've understood that's what the Rambam is saying. However, comes along the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, and he's not entirely happy with the Rambam. And his, if you look at, I think it's the Bir HaGra, you have to find it somewhere, but he says, if I wouldn't say this myself, but he says that the Rambam's position is influenced by the Greek philosophers to say it's all sheker. Says the Gra, really, all these Gemaras are literal. Absolutely, there's a, you can't, Gemara, what's it said in the Gemara, that's what's said, there's a, finished, there's no room for discussion. So, what am I meant to do? The Vilna Gaon says literal, the Rambam says, it's all nonsense, how are we meant to reconcile this? How can we defend the Rambam in his position? So says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky as follows, and this is using our principle. Says Rav Yaakov, in the time of the Gemara, we know that every single Tana, Amoira, in the Gemara was capable, was a Mechaya Mason. That's the levels that they were. They could, just like that. So therefore, you had these great people, Malachi Hashem, who were, their Torah was what it was. Now, well, on the other hand, therefore, there had to be a counter. There were these koichas around. One would be walking, out the town, and there's a demon or something, in order to provide balance, in order to provide a bechira point, in order that there should be a makom toras. In other words, if everyone was going after the Talmidei Chachamim, and even earlier generations, if everyone was going listening to the Nevi'im, then there wouldn't be bechira. On the contrary, the Nevi'im were doing all that they could. And there were these false prophets who were doing all they could the other way. So now all the person was meant to do, to listen to the Novi, the other prophet, he's also doing magic, and he's also saying things, and this, there was a total sort of choice, conflict, as to what on earth to do. But that's the point, meaning at the time, so therefore perhaps we can reconcile, says Rav Yaakov, using our principle. At the time of the Gemara, you had all these koichos, you had all these forces of Torah, therefore there was the other side. Nowadays, when the forces of Ruchnias are so what they are, so therefore that's what the Rambam was talking about, that no, it's nonsense, don't think about it, because we're not quite as strong as we think. And says, it's very interesting, says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky writes, when he was in Kelm, he remembers seeing a letter of Rav Elchanan Wasserman in the name of the Chofetz Chaim, who says that the Dibbuk that they had just, there had just been some incident involving a Dibbuk, and he said this incident of the Dibbuk would be the last one, would probably be the last one, he said. Why? Because he saw that the Koyach of Torah was becoming so weak, and how it was essentially all wiped out in the Kimat. So therefore, this will probably be the last one. In other words, if you want to know the Dibbuk forecast for the day, look up the Torah forecast, and then you'll sort of know what to expect. So they also, says Rav Elchanan Wasserman himself, actually said that Dibbuk, which they had experienced just then, he said that he'll never again be able to get schar for emunah. Never get schar for emunah again. Why? Because this Dibbuk incident provided him, he saw that this is a Ruchnias sticker being, and therefore he would have total emunah. He would have, it could only have come from Hashem, this. Emunah essentially means sort of, in other words, you have the five senses, what you see, taste, feel, etc. Emunah is some kind of belief, and that's where the schar is. Now we have to look for where's Hashem's presence, but that's what emunah is. If it's total clarity, then you can't necessarily get really schar for believing in Hashem, because you haven't passed that nisoyon point, that bechira point. The schar is when you overcome a bechira point. Similarly as well, someone explained that these fossils which are found, aren't found, whatever, but they could also just be another makom taos to make people think, yes, creation must have, etc. So that's essentially what I wanted to say. There is this story, Maharal Shishiva related. I'll just tell you what I know of it, but I think the story goes like this, that the Ponovitch Rav was speaking at some kind of opening, dedication or something for a yeshiva, and he was saying, it's wonderful, the Torah is being rebuilt, so many people are learning, and I think it goes like this, that Rav Shach got up and he said, it's my duty to tell you that it's not so. And there was a whole sort of big commotion, whatever it was, but essentially he was saying that even though we think, yes, it's being rebuilt, but, it's not, don't think it's an aliyah, it's, I don't know, it's sorachin exactly what the kavanah was, I didn't have the full story even. Then my Rosh Hashiva of Moskowitz he was there, he went to Rav Shmuel Rozovsky that night to tell him what happened, and in Yiddish, Rav Shmuel Rozovsky said, he said, in the morning I'm going to go and give Rav Shach a groisa yashakoyach. The idea being that, and this is sort of a bit how these ideas tie into us, that we think we have facilities, Jewish life is thriving, we have kosher facilities and restaurants. But the idea is that what are we aiming for? We're aiming for the time, for the Beis HaMikdash, that it should be rebuilt. If everything is so great, then sort of why isn't Mashiach here quite yet? This is the idea that we don't quite realize that we are on that we're at the end of a 2,000-year golus. Where from what was, we are now what we are. We can only do what we can, but this is where our aliyah point has to be. This is what we have to realize. And I hope these ideas are somewhat interesting and informative. As I say, it does explain the sort of development of from where we were to where we are. All that's left to say is thank everyone for coming. I did, if anyone's interested, I brought along some Haftorah books at the back. If you're going to spend £10 today, I'd say it's a pretty good investment. There's perhaps dozens, even hundreds of Yesodas there to do with the words of the Nevi'im and all the Haftorahs. There's 80 Haftorahs within that book, including all, obviously, Shabbos and all the Yom Tovim ones as well. And that's priced £10. There's a Parsha book next to it for £5 if anyone's interested. And I'd like to thank everyone very much.